welcome to the Sam Cook Lectures with me, Peter Martin. In this podcast series, I'm driven by my navel-gazing curiosity to get guest lecturers to teach me about their specialism. And then, because I'm not a bad sort really, I'll let you, the humans of this world, listen as well. These podcasts are intended as a sort of beginner's guide rather than in-depth analysis, and are the perfect accompaniment to repointing your elderly neighbour's wall or chopping carrots for your tea. This episode, about dialects, was recorded remotely in April 2021 and features Alex Broadhead, an English language and literature lecturer at the University of Liverpool. I'll try saying that twice fast. So welcome to the Sam Cook Lectures. My guest this week is Alex Broadhead, who's going to talk to us about dialects. Hi, Alex.
Hi there, Pete. Thanks for having me on the show, Pete.
Yeah. No problem. Thanks for coming along. So we're going to be talking today about dialects, and in particular, dialects from a couple hundred years ago, right?
Yes. Dialect writing, to be specific. So poems and dialogues and works of fiction that try to represent the speech of a particular place.
Excellent. So I guess my first question for you would be, why are you a good person to talk to about this?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a big fan of dialect writing, especially the earliest stuff. So from the 17th century onwards, really when it first started to appear with any kind of critical mass. But it's also my job. I lecture in language and literature at the University of Liverpool. And my research mainly focuses on 18th century and romantic writers who make use of dialects in their work.
Right, okay. Well, sounds like you are a good person to talk to about it then.
Thanks.
Okay, so we should clarify our terms then. So what do we mean when we say dialect?
So, yeah, it's a very loaded word, dialect, especially in certain places and in some contexts. But basically, a dialect is a version of a particular language. So it can include standard English. But more typically, dialects tend to be associated with a particular place or a particular class or a particular ethnic group. So usually when people talk about dialect writing, they're talking about texts which aren't written in standard English and which, you know, use words you wouldn't find in a regular dictionary or which respell words in a non-standard way in order to capture different pronunciations.
And is dialect something that we find throughout writing in history, or is it a more recent development?
Yeah, so you find regional inflections in the language of texts going right back to Old English. But it's really in the 17th and 18th century that you start to see a divide appearing between the emerging standard English and linguistic varieties associated with other places like Lancashire, like Devon. So it's really at that time, the 17th century, the 18th century, that dialects as we know them first started to be conceptualized and writers first started to self-consciously present themselves as dialect writers.
Okay. And would this, I guess, coincide with the prevalence of, following the invention of the printing press, you're going to get more texts anyway, so it just seems more probable that you'll get dialects, or do you think it's more of a stylistic thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's the product of technological advances, such as the one you just described. It's also the product of, gradually improving transport, especially throughout the 18th century. And that really goes into overdrive with the advent of the trains in the early 19th century. So people are moving around more and they're encountering new voices for the first time. And, you know, also as the rules of standard English start to become codified, as dictionaries start to appear, as people start to get a keener sense of what, you know, so-called correct language is, that makes the linguistic varieties that aren't standard English, the linguistic varieties that don't conform to those rules, it kind of supercharges them with meaning. So then it becomes possible to do interesting things with it in literature and in writing.
Excellent. Okay, sounds fascinating. And I guess we'll come on to this later, but it must really tie in with issues of identity and things like that. You mentioned people moving around and discovering people who spoke differently. This must really tie into to sort of like identity literature.
It does, yeah. I suppose that, you know, there's a difference between now and then in terms of how people articulate and conceptualize identity. And a lot of the people who were writing these texts were sort of occupied an ambivalent relationship with the people that they were representing. So the text I want to talk about today, The Exmoor Scolding, is a great example of that. It's in Devon dialect. It features two sisters who are weavers from Exmoor, which is a kind of rural part of Devon. Now, it was written by a chap called Andrew Bryce, who almost certainly had would have had a regional accent, would have been a user of dialect. But he was from Exeter. So it's in Devon, but it's in the city. So he kind of belongs to the same broad regional community as the people he's representing, but also he's a city boy and he's making fun of country people. So
some things don't change, right?
Yeah, well indeed, yeah. And so he's kind of got one foot in and one foot out of the community.
So would you say that dialect would be something that we talked about, you've mentioned region there. So is this something that people would have been conscious of? So I have a Devon dialect, for example. We talked about people moving around and meeting people from other places who spoke differently. Do you think they would have known, like, this is of this area? I'm guessing yes by this point.
Well, that's a really good point, Pete. And it really goes to the heart of what a dialect is. So there's a school of thought in sociolinguistics at the moment that tells us that dialects exist only as ideas. So yeah, you can go from one place to another and you'll notice that people speak differently. I live in Sheffield, I work in Liverpool, I'll catch the train over and there's an obvious, obvious difference between how people talk. So linguistic variation is real. But in reality, it's messy. It's hard to say where one dialect starts and another ends. People, you know, in the course of a sentence will switch from one way of talking to another. Dialects, so the argument goes, are tools which help us to make sense of the incredibly messy business of linguistic variation. And dialects don't pop fully formed into life. So Tony Crowley, for instance, has talked about the Scouse dialect. He suggests that the Scouse dialect as we know it only really started to be conceptualized in the kind of 19th century, and then really in the mid 20th century. It's not just that the linguistic features were already there; the idea has to be created. Someone has to, or rather, people gradually, incrementally, have to start making connections between the idea of a place and specific linguistic forms. So texts like these are helping to bring these dialects into being. They're kind of inventing dialects in a sense.
Okay, like inadvertently codifying them, I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. And as you mentioned, so for example, you live in Sheffield, I used to live in Yorkshire, and you can travel around Yorkshire and people will get very particular about which part of Yorkshire you're from, how people speak in different parts of Yorkshire. I mean, Yorkshire's not one county, of course, and people from West Yorkshire might talk differently to people from South Yorkshire. All alien to a Liverpool boy like me, perhaps. But it's something that continues to this day, but perhaps in more in like accent rather than dialect, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, phonology is probably the place where the differences are keenest. Then again, I suppose there are always specific words, aren't there? There's specific phrases and expressions. If you think about the Arctic Monkeys, for instance, when people talk about the Arctic Monkeys helping to popularize Sheffield dialect, it's often specific words that people will cite, so Mardy, Summit, rather than specific pronunciations.
Yeah, but of course that's often lost in music, so phonological features can shift in song in a way that, you know, for example, lots of Americans are surprised that British people quote sing in American. But that's a whole different conversation. But I guess for our purposes today, when we talk about dialect, we're talking partly about accent, but partly about, but I guess in a large proportion about vocabulary, about words and phrases, yes. And the way grammatical, there might be grammatical or syntax kind of differences, sure. In an area.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we presumably then, like all language, dialect changes and shifts. So when we look at a text, yeah. from the 18th century, as we're about to do, plausibly we wouldn't recognise large parts of it, even if we're, yeah. not from Devon, even if we are from Devon, sorry, because the language has, yeah. shifted and changed, right?
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, you know, those things I mentioned before, geographical mobility, social mobility, the advent of mass media, these are all going to change not only how people talk, but also how we conceptualize and distinguish between other dialects. Added to which, you know, you've got new forms of social marginalization, new forms of social stratification, you know, the kind of polarization of different social groups. That's not going away anytime soon, is it? And that's going to give rise to different ways of talking and different ways of conceptualizing other ways of talking. So all of that will make this look quite foreign. It's worth noting, though, that, you know, these writers most probably created a lot of the words that they used. And they're also, they're using a very blunt tool, in the English spelling system, in order to try to capture nuances of pronunciation. So one of the things that I love about these texts is that they're so inventive, they're so creative, they're experimental texts, even though they present themselves as, you know, representing a dying traditional culture. They're not really. I mean, they're creating dialects on all of these things. So, you know, social change, linguistic change, the inventiveness of the writer will mean that it's, even for a person from that area, and hypothetically for a person from that area at that time, it's still going to seem quite foreign to them. They're still going to have a job to do to try to decode the text.
Okay. So you mentioned there about creativity, which is something that's really appealing in texts generally. You mentioned that they might be creating words. Do you mean, say, okay, for listeners, perhaps a modern, quote, modern equivalent might be Roald Dahl, who peppers his children's books with words he's clearly made up. Do you mean that they've completely, yep. made up the word, or as you alluded to, do you mean just that they're attempting to put into spelling words that would only have been heard?
Yeah, a bit from column A and a bit from column B.
Okay,
I think. So you get, in the 19th century, you get people writing commentaries on these works. Now, admittedly, they're writing 150 years after the event. And what they'll do is try to cross-reference the spellings and the words used against other accounts, more recent accounts, and what they themselves know of the dialects. And every so often you'll get a commentator saying, yeah, no one talks like this in Devon. You know, he's up. But yeah, the other thing is true as well, that, you know, this is a provisional attempt to write down something that's never been written down before, to capture speech sounds that have never been captured before. So both of those things, I think, you know, they're creative in both of those senses.
Okay, and I guess writers are sometimes credited with inventing words just because they're the first written example of it. Shakespeare, obviously, is the famous example.
Indeed.
He didn't necessarily invent all the words he's credited with inventing. He just, the folios of his work might be the earliest, yeah. example.
So how about we have a look at the text, Pete?
Okay, yeah, so let's take a look at the text. Can you remind me, what was it called?
It's called The Exmoor Scolding. So it first appeared in 1726 and was most probably written by a man called Andrew Bryce. It appeared in his newspaper, Bryce's Weekly Journal, and it's a conversation between two sisters, two weavers. It's scurrilous, it's offensive, there's a lot of misogynistic language in it, and it culminates in an act of physical violence. So I wondered if you and I, Pete, might... play the roles of these two sisters, if we could perhaps two parts.
I mean, that sounds like a description of my podcast anyway, to be perfectly honest. So this is The Exmoor Scolding, and you will be playing the part of one of the sisters, and I will be playing the part of the other sister, and we're going to have a bit of a row, right?
We're going to have a little row. Yeah, I'll be Thomasin, you'll be Wilmot. I hope you don't mind. I'm not going to attempt the accent here, which might seem strange given that this is my speciality, but I think with things like this, unless you're going to do it absolutely right, it's probably better just to do it in your own accent and be guided where possible by the spellings. But you are very welcome, Pete, to attempt an Exmoor accent.
Very deftly passing that on to me. I think we'll get letters if we deviate from the truly correct pronunciation. So let's make a best stab at it. And
yes,
and I'm open to correction from anyone from Devon.
Terrific. Letters would be nice, wouldn't they, in this day and age? That shows effort. And
I say letters and just
online
abuse.
Yes. Do you have the text in front of you?
I have my script here, yes.
Okay, so I'll begin. And then perhaps I'll read the translation afterwards.
It might be good so people have a sense of what on earth it was we've just said, and people at home could compare.
Indeed. Okay. Lock Wilmot, the Wyvor Destroilizo, upon mount to Chalacum roll. Ease didn't think the hadden a bizitch a lab of the tongue. What a vengeance! What be totaled, or what the baggaged? Or hadst thou took a shord or a paddle?
I roily upon thee, ye girt, thonging, banging, muxy drawbreech. Noah, 'twas thee roilst upon me, up to Darity Vrogwills, upsitting. When thou vunkst to, and he be hanged to thee, to Rabin. Should zem thou wart zek, arter me at, and me al?
Excellent, that was beautiful, Pete. That was both spirited and also, I think, in the spirit of the spellings.
I just wanted to sound a little bit grumpy. I feel like my final line shouldn't really have been a question, should have been more accusatory.
Yes. Okay. Well, that was a thing of beauty.
Well, could you give us a sense of what it was about, and give us a kind of an attempt at a modern translation? Or you do your part, and I'll do mine, perhaps.
Yeah, well, so this is a rough translation that I've tried to piece together from subsequent accounts and glossaries. So I should say I specialise in dialect writing, but by no stretch of the imagination am I an expert in Devon dialect. So this is kind of loose. There are individual words where I'm not 100% sure. But here we go. So Thomason says, "What, Wilmot? Why did you have a go at me all the way up to Chalacum Roll? I didn't think you'd been such a blabbermouth. Were you seized with a fit of chattering, or were you bewitched, or were you drunk?"
To which Wilmot responds, "I have a go at you, you great, flouncy, large, lazy, filthy, disreputable woman. No, it was you who had a go at me all the way to Darity Vrogwill's christening feast when you acted as godmother. And you'll be hanged to Rabin or Robin. And it seems you were sick after meat and meal."
Yep. And it all goes downhill from there.
Oh, right. It gets more abusive. Yeah. I must say that, as an aside, Darity Vrogwill's christening feast sounds like a kind of a 1970s sort of psych folk band gone wrong.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's right. From Green Bay, Wisconsin. Yeah.
So this is the presumably the start of an argument, and then what becomes a slanging match effectively after this.
Yes, absolutely, all the way through. Yeah.
It's a familiar scenario, right? Two sisters have obviously been at an event together. Something's gone down, and they, you know, they're chewing this over afterwards, and they've obviously each of them's got a little festering grievance with the other from how they've behaved, and you can kind of get a sense for it, right? So there's been a christening.
Absolutely.
One or likely both is a little bit inebriated. They've behaved with some absence of decorum, and now they're kind of calling each other out on it, but perhaps they've got different recollections of the event, but presumably neither of them would come out well.
There are definitely discrepancies, undoubtedly. Yeah, I think that notwithstanding that it's, you know, the spellings and the words will seem so odd, especially to people not from the region, but even perhaps to some extent to those from the region, it's kind of helping the reader a little bit. You can see it's a dialogue. You can see from the fact that they're calling each other names, that it's probably not a particularly amicable discussion. They're falling out. They're often repeating what the other one says. And so you can start to kind of recognise the broad scenario that's going on. And I think in doing that, in using dialogue, the writer's trying to help the reader a little bit to guide them. There's a kind of question that comes up when other people have written about this. You know, how offensive would this have been to, you know, you kind of polite early 18th century reader? Would they have been scandalized by the scurrilous language? Possibly, but as you say, it's a familiar situation as well. These are two sisters. You know, anyone with siblings, anyone who remembers their youth will remember, you know.
It's bickering, basically.
Yeah, your arguments in this broad ballpark. And I think, you know, it has its... Yeah, there are kind of modern equivalents, aren't they, in sitcoms. I'm thinking of, you know, Steptoe and Son, for instance, or you know, the now forgotten sitcom by Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson, Bottom, where they just sort of batter each other and insult each other. There's something cathartic about reading it or watching it.
And there's no stronger argument than that between people who love each other, right?
Indeed.
You mentioned then, would it have been offensive? And there's lots of cases of this in kind of what sprung to mind when you said that is the TV series Dead was set in the Gold Rush in the United States, and they've had to kind of update all the kind of gosh darn it kind of rootin' tootin' kind of stuff to try and make it sound as powerful as it would have done to people's ears at the time. Yes. The kind of the blaspheming would sound less powerful today, so they've, you know, they've littered it with more up-to-date swearing, which I'll spare the listener, but you can guess there's lots of four-letter words appearing in that, just to try and give it the power. Do you think this would have been softer because they're siblings, or do you think, and again, it's dialect, so who knows, but maybe you know, but do you think it would have been powerful, or is it more kind of like the way you might use a softer insult with a friend or family member?
Oh, I think it's quite powerful. I mean, if you sort of look at some of the glossary definitions of the words used. I mean, drawbreach gives you an example of what's being imputed there.
Right. Okay. I see.
You know, it's very physical. It's.
But this is the beginning, right? No. So at this point, they are kind of, they're just sort of accusing each other's behavior. You did this, you did that. What you're saying, I did this.
Oh, it gets
and
worse.
Then presumably, it just descends into name calling, right?
It gets a lot worse, yeah. as I say, very visceral, very, very physical. So in some ways, you know, worse than simple swearing, and given the kind of vividness of the descriptions and the accusations.
Can we look at a couple of the examples of the words then? Because as you mentioned, just kind of like, you know, you could do discourse analysis and you can kind of get a feel for how this would have gone back and forth just because of the way language works and it hasn't really shifted or changed significantly in hundreds of years. The same way that children can kind of ape, you know, you see videos of babies online kind of copying the way conversations work. So to some extent you can get that kind of a feel, but there's other little bits where you kind of think, okay, well, you know, I can guess it's a verb, or I can guess it's a noun that you're being called. So, are there any examples you'd like to draw out for us here?
Well, I wondered if we could have a little pop quiz, Pete. If I could get you to try to guess the meaning of some of the words.
Okay, yeah, go on then.
You've got your work cut out for you. I must say the definitions I've used in this instance have come from a 1782 edition. The text, which included a glossary, some of the definitions raise more questions than the answer. But let's see how we get on. So I'm gonna put my first word to you now, Pete. Betwattled.
Betwattled. Okay. So it sounds like an adjective based on the ed ending. I'm gonna guess that it is someone who has been put down, verbally put down by someone in an uncouth manner.
Good effort, and I can see you working out there. Actually, it means to be seized with a fit of chattering or gossiping.
Oh, right, okay.
So I'm not sure if there is an exact synonym for it in standard English.
Right, so instead of just saying you are a gossip or a chatterbox, it's like saying that this came upon you. You're a victim for more passive.
Yes, you've possessed by a chattering demon. Yeah. Okay. This one you might be able to work out. Platvutted.
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 Oh right. Okay. Platvutted. Well, again, it's got an ed. Is it some form of inebriation?
In this instance, it's flat-footed.
Oh, right. Right.
Flat, yeah, so it's a re-spelling, really, rather than a word.
I guess that was obvious.
Okay, here's one for you. And this is an instance where the definition raises more questions than it answers. Loblolly.
Loblolly. Okay, that sounds like a noun, maybe? Is this an insult? Someone's been called a loblolly? Mm. Lob, has this got any connection to, like, throw? Or lolly will have no connection to the modern word. I'm going to say it's an insult. I don't know.
It is. Well, it's an odd mixture of the worst kind of spoon meat.
Apparently. Spoon meat?
Spoon meat, yes. And then what's the best kind of spoon meat, or even the mediumest kind of spoon meat? Who can say?
I mean, not loblolly, obviously. Wouldn't be caught dead having loblolly. Maybe sometimes you come home drunk and just raid the fridge, but yeah. Not one for when you've got
guests. When you've scraped the barrel with your spoon, I think that's what you have on the end of your spoon.
Okay.
Loblolly.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound appealing.
No, indeed. I'm going to give you two more now. I'll give you one more, actually. And I may be mispronouncing this. Crudling.
Can you repeat that? Crude?
I'll tell you it's a noun. Crudling.
Crudling.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so crude is a familiar word. Someone who speaks poorly, someone who is uncouth.
Well, you've fallen victim there, Pete, to the false friend that linguists so often warn us against. Crudling, apparently, is a cold, dull, inactive, and sickly person whose blood seems to be, as it were, curdled. So I think with crudling, what's happened there is that the E and the R have been transposed. It's an example of metathesis. So crude is
like curd.
Where it's curd, but the sounds have been mixed round.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, it's very specific. A very kind of semantically narrow, isn't it? These words are incredibly rich with really specific meanings. Again, for which there's no exact synonym in standard English.
Yeah.
But you did very well there, and I thought you gave it your best shot. Your working out was plain to see.
Do you get points for that? I feel like on the game show, I would be going away empty-handed, though, and there would be a "Here's what you could have won behind the curtain." I wonder what I could have won in an 18th century game show on dialect.
Loblolly.
Loblolly. I go away with a loblolly. So we touched upon this before. So is it plausible that this text wouldn't really have been understood outside of a particular region, outside the broader Devon region?
It's hard to say. There was definitely a lot of interest in it outside the region. So it's first published in 1726 locally. And then in the 1740s, it's reprinted in the Gentleman's Magazine, which is a national periodical. And thereafter, it gets reprinted a bunch of times. And there are some good books on the subject which talk about it, its kind of textual history and its 18th century reception. So there's one by a woman called Janet Sorensen, and another by a man called Daniel Dewis-Pilair. And they talk about the way that the contemporary readers might have received it. Certainly, it's being reprinted a lot on a national stage. So this tells you that people wanted to understand it and people were curious about it. So I would guess that, you know, if the will's there, then the likelihood is that people started to form kind of broad, educated understandings of the text. Yeah.
And I guess that's how it was written. It strikes me as it's sort of like an exercise in kind of playing with this dialect. I mean, it wasn't just written as a verbatim exchange that someone had overheard. The writer is intentionally trying to chuck as much of this in as possible, right?
Indeed, it's so energetic. There's this amazing ebullience about it, you know, squeezing as many words, as many respellings, squeezing as much out of the spellings as they can. So part of my research is looking at, you know, the different functions that spelling had. On one level, quite obviously, it was attempting to represent sound. You know, it does the obvious job as well of marking specific social identities, but it's doing a bunch of other stuff as well. Sometimes it's bound up with etymology. It's telling you something about where these words have come from or where the writers think they come from. It's telling you things about the audience as well. Certain spellings presuppose that readers will be familiar with this convention or that convention. So it's incredibly rich and incredibly dense.
And of course, yeah, one of the great problems of English spelling is the fact that there's the great vowel shift where the pronunciation of vowels has changed over time in English. But I guess by this point it would be becoming a bit more settled. And as you mentioned, people would be familiar with spelling conventions to some degree.
Well, yes, yes. Although, well, yeah, the spelling was definitely settled. But what you also have in the 17th and 18th century are philologists who are, in small ways, attempting to reform spelling in order to indicate where words come from. So that's why you get, you know, the silent B in debt, for instance. So, yes, it's settled. People are tweaking it a little bit. But yeah, it's absolutely the settling, the standardization of the spelling system that makes this kind of writing possible and that makes it so meaningful as well, I think.
Okay, so we've had a nice little exploration of an example of this, and we touched upon earlier the idea of like dialects and language changing. And so the obvious question would be, you know, do dialects die out or do they just change?
They change, I think, Pete. You know, county lines get redrawn, cities grow, towns disappear, new kind of social arrangements appear. You get migration within a country and without, and all of these things change how people speak. And I talked earlier about the invention of dialects, the invention of an idea of a dialect. Well, things like mass media, social media, can help to kind of create new categories in order to make sense of the changes as well.
So going forward then, do you think the future will be bright for dialect? Do you think in another 300 years people will look back to this time and find a rich variety of regional dialects? Or, is that enabled by modern technology? Or do you think that with mass media, we're more likely to have a kind of a unified, standardized, you know, version of the language that has less wiggle room for dialect?
No, I think the former certainly, and those two things aren't mutually exclusive. So standardization creates more opportunities for doing meaningful things with non-standard writing. So there's a wealth of research out there on non-standard spelling on different social media sites and in fanzine culture as well. And in fact, a lot of those examples give you quite a kind of vivid modern illustration of how people writing can use spelling in order to presuppose a particular audience. You know, at its grimmest, you find it in the kind of semi-coded messages of the alt-right in America, where they have certain typographical and orthographical conventions in order to kind of
hide messages and plain
say offensive things in a kind of dog whistle fashion for other people, you know, belonging to that world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, on that bleak note. So if anyone was interested in learning a bit more about this, where could they go?
Well, there's an excellent book already out there written by Jane Hodson, who's a professor at the University of Sheffield. Her book's called Dialect in Film and Literature. I've explored some of these issues in relation to the poetry of the Scottish writer Robert Burns. My book's called The Language of Robert Burns, Style, Ideology and Identity. If you're interested in reading the raw stuff, then there's an absolute world of it at your fingertips online. Obviously, the copyright has elapsed on these texts, given that they were published hundreds of years ago. Get on Google Books, get on advanced search, set the date parameters at something like 1700 to 1800, and write in, if Devon dialect is your thing, write in Devon dialect or Somerset dialect, or write in dialect poetry and see what kind of hidden gems you can come up with.
Excellent. I'd be really interested to hear if anyone listening would like to do recordings of their own versions of anything they find. Please send them on. We'd be happy to listen, and I'm sure Alex would critique them as well.
Oh, I would relish them.
Okay, we'll put links to all of that below in the podcast notes, including to Alex's book if you want to check it out. All that remains for me to do is to say thank you very much, Alex, for coming on and explaining dialect a little bit to us.
Thanks, Pete. It was a pleasure and a privilege.
This episode of the Sam Cook Lectures featured Alex Broadhead, an English language and literature lecturer at the University of Liverpool and author of The Language of Robert Burns, published by Bucknell University Press. The podcast was produced by Old Rope. Go to oldrope.co.uk for our blog and more podcasts. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at TheOldRope and Facebook/TheOldRope. The fabulous podcast artwork is a portrait of Sam Cook by Sarah Bilton at Bilton_art for commissions. Please share this podcast with any pals who might like it, and hopefully see you next time.